We'll call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Today is Monday, February 19th. We're in the State Capitol Building. Today we have with us Co-Chairman McKinnon, Senator Bishop, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Olson, Senator Stevens, and we should be joined shortly by Senator Machicki, who's at a press availability event. Today we'll be taking up the governor's amendments for the operating supplemental and the capital budgets. They are in Senate Bill 142 for the capital budget, 144 for the operating loans and funds, and Senate Bill 166, the supplemental appropriations and amendments. I would like to ask, members do have a binder in front of them with the summaries and spreadsheets and details of each request. We will have the director of OMB making the presentation today. Ms. Pat Pitney, can you approach the table and whoever you want to assist you with and begin with your presentation?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Pat Pitney. I'm the director for the Office of Management and Budget. With me today is Neil Steininger, our chief budget analyst. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Neil and then weigh in when I'm needed.
Good morning. For the record, Neil Steininger, Chief Budget Analyst, Office of Management and Budget. So this morning we'll be going over the amendments. Up on the screen in front of you is a summary of the amendments to the FY19 budget. Operating amendments, total of $2.6 million UGF, $250,000 DGF, and $2.3 million in federal funds. The fund transfers represents deposits of various funds back into the general fund. That's why that's a negative number. Capital, we have $10 million in UGF and $14.2 million in federal funds. These will be detailed on that spreadsheet, and we can go through the individual lines. The first three items are actually amendments to the FY18 supplemental request. Amendment actually reduces the amount of
So this is the spreadsheet that has each item, and we'll go through each item.
Brief eddies. Call the meeting back to order. We've been joined by Senator Machicki, and we're getting some feedback, so whoever has their phone on vibrate, if they could turn that off so we could have a better recording. With that, Pat Pitney, please proceed.
So we'll turn it back over to Neil Steininger to go through the list of amendments.
So the first item, line 2 on the list, is a reduction of $7 million in unrestricted general funds. When we presented the budget in December, at the time the federal government had not yet reauthorized the Children's Health Insurance Program. So we included a supplemental request for the cost difference in anticipated loss in federal revenue if they had not reauthorized. Subsequent to that time, they did reauthorize that program, which reduces the need for unrestricted general fund for that program. The federal match is still built into the FY18 budget request. Items 5 and 6 are reappropriations from the Susitna-Watonna project from the remaining balance. The first is $960,000 for Newtok Matarvik Community Development. This is to assist in relocation efforts and match to Denali Commission funding. The second on line six is an estimate of $899,700 for enhanced rural safety. This is a capital project in the governor's office, and that's to ensure there's coordination between several different departments within the state. There's no one department that's entirely responsible for rural safety. So the governor's office will coordinate with the various departments to ensure a holistic approach. Starting on line 10, these are amendments to the FY19 budget. Line 10 is just a technical correction to align the fund source for the Office of Information Technology. We had originally presented it using interagency receipts. However, Information Services Fund receipts are the more appropriate fund source for information technology activities. Line 11 is a position within the Department of Education and Early Development, Student and School Achievement, at a cost of 97,000 UGF. This position is a research analyst to do data collection, analysis, and reporting. Currently, the research analysts within the department are federally funded and can only really perform work on specific federal reports. Adding a state-funded position will allow value-added analysis and data collection to assist districts in providing better service to for education. Line 12 is the addition of general fund program receipt authority for the Mount Edgecombe Aquatic Center for $250,000 in designated general funds. This was just an oversight. This allows them to collect fees for use of that facility for rentals and people coming in and using the facility. On the next page, line 13, this is a position for Health and Social Services, Office of Children's Services, for a safety officer in the amount of 111 Southern UGF 47.6 in federal funds. The safety officer will help to coordinate training and coaching and interaction with various public safety agencies to ensure the safety of OCS caseworkers. The office has received considerable numbers of threats of physical harm to their employees, as well as vandalism at some of their facilities and OSHA violations related to workers being exposed to threats of harm. So this position would try to coordinate and create a program to stem some of these things.
Where would this position be located, and how would it assist? Is there additional travel funds, or how would this individual perform their duties?
Chair Hoffman, we have Shonda O'Brien with us. If you would like, she could come up and answer. She's actually right here. If you would like to have her answer.
Okay.
Good morning. For the record, this is Shonda O'Brien, the Assistant Commissioner for Health and Social Services. The position right now would be located in what we call our state office. As far as travel expenses go, we aren't anticipating that the position will have significant travel. I think the division is anticipating that they would work a program that could be used through their online training.
And has this position been... the needs have been, they've been requested by the 52 districts. How many districts are interested and have requested this type of coordination?
Mr. Chair, the position is actually being created or needed as a result of several fines. The The division is in receipt of some penalties in addition to a lawsuit that they're also in the midst of, resulting from a former employee being assaulted.
Senator McKinnon.
Mr. Chairman, we have quite a few state offices, so is that Juneau then? Are you telling us it's a Juneau position?
Presently, I believe it is going to be located in Juneau, either Juneau or Anchorage, where it would be more central to the bulk of the workforce. In the state office, it would have a little bit more exposure to the management areas and some of the resources that we have here. But I don't believe that the division has decided yet which location for sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator McKinnon. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to clarify. This is calling it a children's services, established children's services safety officer. This is for the safety of the employees, not the students, right?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens. You. Yes, you're right.
Thank you. Thank you for that explanation, Director Pitney.
Moving to line 14, somewhat related to the safety officer, this is to allow the Office of Children's Services to contract with an outside firm for security guards at their Kenai and Fairbanks offices at a cost of 129 UGF and 72,000 in federal funds. Currently, most of their larger offices have contracted security guards. However, Kenai and Fairbanks do not and have received threats and vandalism in those locations. Line 15 is for the Division of Public Assistance within Health and Social Services in the amount of 2.2 million UGF and 2.2 million in federal funds. This is to create new positions which will address the increase in caseloads and help to stem the backlog in public assistance applications that has built up over the past several years. Line 16 is for the Department of Natural Resources, the Office of Project Management and Permitting, 100,000 in UGF. This is for the Alaska Geospatial Council. The Geospatial Council has been supported by a capital project since 2015. Those capital funds are set to run out towards the end of fiscal year 19. This $100,000 would allow them to continue operations through the end of the year.
On this particular item, this is has been an ongoing operation to coordinate state agencies and federal agencies on the mapping priorities for the state. We anticipate this is an ongoing function, but we want to examine how it's been working. It's been working on capital projects since the early 2000s, and we do believe it's an ongoing function and should be built into the operating budget, so it would be something to expect in about the 400,000 range in the 2020 operating budget, getting it off of the capital budget as it's an ongoing function.
The total of the operating amendments to the FY19 budget, the 2.6 million UGF, 250,000 DGF, and 2.3 million in federal receipts. These next six items are somewhat technical, but I'll go through them and explain each as I go.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you tell me how many new positions that you're requesting in the supplemental that's before us?
42.
I see at least 43, 44. So
The security guards are, I'm sorry, through the chair, Senator McKinnon, the security guards are contracts. They're not positions. The safety officer is a position as well as the caseloads.
Senator McKinnon?
On the data collection, correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On line 15, can you tell me how many new costs will, as we process the claims faster to qualify for eligibility for public assistance, how much that will drive the cost for matching money for the state as we move people onto the system faster?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, that is indeterminate. It is those people that are eligible by the statutes that exist are on right now. There are people waiting several months for things like food stamps, and food stamps are 100% federal funded. There are also people who are waiting to get on to to Medicaid, which is, depending on the type of person, either 90% federally funded or, in some cases, 50% federal funded. But it is just addressing the backlog for those Alaskans that are in need of service.
Senator McKinnon.
Mr. Chairman, everyone at this table knows that the state is facing upwards of $2.5 billion worth of draw. And it's just difficult to listen to a presentation that is adding so many new or requesting to add so many new positions. Has any of these positions already been hired?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, no, they have not.
The question is on line 15. You have those 41 additional positions to address what's shown here as a backlog. So how long will it take to address that backlog, and do you anticipate that after the backlog is addressed that those positions would be no longer needed?
Chair Hoffman, I believe the after discussing with Health and Social Services, the number of applicants and the current backlog, we'd estimate between 3 to 5 years. There's also continuing to advance the information technology systems, and you know the impact of the recession has increased applications. So it's possible that if the recession begins to ease, there might be fewer, but we're estimating 3 to 5 years.
Senator McKinnon.
Mr. Chairman, this is for you, and we can go look at it later, but I believe we had a similar request to address the backlog, if not last year, then the year before, and there were double-digit people being hired to address the backlog then, as I recall. So we should just take a look and see how many new positions have been added in the last few years. Health and Social Services has not been able to control their costs, so it's unfortunate.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you. Ms. Pitney, was this request made before the MOU was signed with Native corporations and organizations to start handling some of their own OCS duties? And does that soften, now that that formal commitment is in place, does that soften the need for adding some or all of these positions?
Director.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, this request was made probably in the same time frame as the MOU, but this is taking into account the effort that we anticipate to be able to coordinate with those entities.
Senator Machicki.
I'm a little confused. Most of the increase that Hess was asking for was more related to OCS than public assistance field services. So this is a new request for 41. This isn't the OCS requests that were made last year that they were talking about coming back for additional funding this year. This is a new request for 41 positions.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, that is correct. The Office of Children's Services was 31 positions, but the funding that was provided did not cover the 31 positions, so they're in the budget we presented in December. There's the remaining funding for the OCS positions This is the eligibility technicians that address the all the public assistance, whether it's senior benefits, food stamps, Medicaid, heating assistance, those type of programs.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Pitney, so if these 41 positions were added and then they began to address the backlog, and I think I heard you briefly said about 5 years, but let's say they're very efficient and they do it in 2 years and they get caught up, have you done an analysis of what the downstream effects will be on the state budget once all of those 500 to 600 folks are added in the various different programs with various different matches, whether it's, you know, 90%, 50% between state and federal? And so by adding these positions and doing eligibility, it's just nice to know what the future impact will be also on the bottom line once eligibility is caught up.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, that is indeterminate at this point. Some people will be eligible, some people will not. Some will be on 90%, some will be on 50%. Some will be in programs like food stamps that are 100% federal funded. And it's just addressing those people who meet the requirements for those services.
One last.
Senator Von Imhoff.
And is there any way to, because I understand that other states have outsourced some of this or have just gotten a private contractor to help address this. Is that something that your department has looked into?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, yes, we have. It's we are in the midst of two technology implementations at the point those. So right now we're running on two systems and working hard to meld those systems so we have one system for the public assistance. At that point, looking at outsourcing or looking at partnerships with other nonprofit entities in the state will be a possibility. I think our unique geography deems that there needs to be some physical presence for our eligibility technicians in the state.
Senator Von Imhoff. Thank you, Senator Von Imhoff. Senator McKinnon and Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm interested in Senator Machicki's comments about a signed MOU with Senator Machicki. Is that Tribal Health Corporations?
Thank you.
Senator
Mr. Chairman, yeah, we had a presentation by HASS. It's tribal organizations in the state have signed an MOU to share some of their responsibilities to localize some of the handling of a portion of the OCS-related cases. It's probably a summarized description of the effort.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman. Director Pitney, we have shared services with smaller communities throughout Alaska. I'm thinking of, I think it was either Nome or Barrow that had taken over health care responsibilities, and then because they could not get increases from the state government, they chose to return those responsibilities to the state, and then the same individuals were rehired at the higher rate as we took on the health care costs to manage that. Are we doing something like that with these 41, or inside of the department, are we supporting the MOUs that are being signed with state workers to help with the eligibility?
Director Pitney.
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, these 41 are not currently eligibility technicians in any organization.
Great. Senator McKinnon.
Mr. Chairman, that's why I hesitated and went back and said, is the state going to support with state dollars eligibility under MOUs or otherwise for other organizations trying to manage eligibility for folks in local communities?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, I will ask Shonda O'Brien to answer that if you'd like.
Senator Mr. Bryan, did you get the question?
I believe so. For the record, again, this is Shonda O'Brien. If I understand your question correctly, you're wondering whether these staff potentially would be signing agreements or are currently covered under agreements with other organizations?
Mr. Chairman, if I might clarify, I don't want to go to this 41 because we always, I feel like we're playing ring around the rosy because if I don't ask the question right, I'm not going to get an accurate answer. So it's not just this 41. Is DHSS going to supplant state workers somewhere where we're picking up the cost and we sign these memorandums of agreements with local communities to either through eligibility or through OCS enforcement? Are we backfilling state dollars as these organizations are taking on responsibilities? Are we still paying for them? That's what I'm trying to get to.
Thank you for that.
Mr. Bryan.
So the compacting is what Senator Maticki was referring to with OCS. It's a compact agreement. That agreement is with certain tribal organizations and tribes to take on certain aspects of work from the Office of Children's Services. We aren't intending to backfill any of those costs. We're intending to offset state dollar costs with the support that we'll be receiving from the tribes. These positions for DPA are not going to be outsourced. The type of work that they do requires that they remain state employees. There are some federal regulations that prohibit us from outsourcing or using other entities to do this work. We've tried to find some other ways that we could address the backlog issue with taking into consideration some of our tribal organizations and the work that they do. There are certain programs that they could help us with, but most of the backlog is in Medicaid. And so there are some rules that prohibit us from using the other entities to help us with that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator McKinnon. The backlog that you're referring to, do you have an estimation of how many there are in which categories there exist and what part of the state they come from?
Mr. Chair, the last number I saw was about 15,000 applications in backlog. The majority of those, I believe about 14,000, are Medicaid. We have some exact numbers, though, that we could share with you in the committee if you prefer.
And do you have locales as well?
Mr. Chairman, I think the division could give us locations. I'm not sure how difficult it would be for them to pull that data together, but I'm sure that we can get it.
Thank you. We'd appreciate to look at that information. Director Pitney.
Mr. Chairman.
No, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure who to ask this question of, because most recently at the end of January, we've had a number of calls from constituents, especially elderly ones over 90 years old, who were saying that their food stamps did not come in time, and because of the winter and the severity of it, they were having to go ahead and wait, which I see is no fault of their own. But the question that I have for you is that once they're certified eligible, are their benefits then retroactive? And so as I look at it from a holistic standpoint, it's almost like there's faster service without any additional cost. Is that true?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the Medicaid applications are retroactive to the date of application, and I believe they go back even before the date of application in some cases. With food stamps, I would have to check with the division to find out whether they're retroactive to the date of application or not. I'm not confident that I know the answer to that one.
Okay. Senator, and the last statement about faster service versus additional cost?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, could you rephrase it in a way that
it almost appears that there is, because it's retroactive, there's no additional significant cost to it, but there is faster service. Is that true? Or am I reading it wrong?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, so if you're talking about the instances where we work the applications because of the emergent need or because we get a call from somebody saying that there's some seriousness to the, that to some degree does get worked faster, but then, the other work that exists would be put off to another day. And so it's a constant shuffle of priority for that moment in time. Some of the statistics that I have for the staffing levels is pretty astounding. The number of vacancies that the division has right now, this very moment, are 73. In a workforce of several hundred people, that's pretty significant. It's about a third. The number of positions that turned over in the past year were 144. The average length of vacancy is about 5 months. So, you know, they're kind of dealing with a lot of those workforce challenges in addition to addressing the more emergent crisis situation needs where, you know, somebody's food stamps got shut off and they have to work that application right now and get those needs met. But that's kind of what they're dealing with on a daily basis in all areas because everybody is important.
No further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson, how many positions currently do you have filling these, processing these applications? And how did it come out that there's 15,000 that are that we're behind at this stage? It seems as though that should not have happened.
Mr. Chairman, so there's approximately 260 positions, I believe, that process eligibility work and then various support staff in addition to that. The backlog is attributed to a number of different factors, and so some of it is due to an increase in the number of applications. Right now, they're receiving about 11,000 new applications monthly. In addition to working the new applications, they also have a recertification process for existing eligible persons, and so there are recertification requirements for food stamps and Medicaid, in addition to the senior benefits program, where we have, I think, over 11,000 recipients right now. So there's those challenges in addition to the system challenges that Director Pitney spoke of, where they're working in two systems for most of the programs. That IT work is underway, and there will be some efficiencies in the short term and the long term, but you know, getting that system built will definitely be a priority in addressing some of the backlog issues. And then just the volume of applications. Sometimes the marketplace, the federally facilitated marketplace, adds to the backlog because the transactions between our system and theirs don't always work timely. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Okay. Senator Bishop, then Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is kind of a loaded question and is because you just described inside this public assistance, these 41 positions, it covers a myriad of services, correct? Everything from food stamps, maybe heating oil, maybe Medicaid services, et cetera, et cetera. And where I'm going with this is the backlog and the additional backlog going forward. And I was just wondering, have you folks done any back of the envelope costs of what the additional costs are to the state and to the system by not being up to speed and hitting these targets in a timely fashion, i.e. extended, you know, a bigger medical cost because you can't get in to see the doctor and your system manifests or those types of things?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, those are some really great things for calculating our costs that we just haven't had the staffing resources to focus on. We would have to have dedicated research analysts just looking at that information alone. The Division of Public Assistance and the Department currently aren't directing resources at those kinds of things, but those are definitely some really great considerations for trying to project our costs in the future, but that's just not something that we've been able to do.
Senator Bishop,
just to follow up, Mr. Chairman, thank you. That's a lot. What I roll on is a cost benefit analysis when you're looking at, you know, increasing the budget. So I want to make sure people get served in a timely fashion. But you know, if you can put some numbers with the increase, that helps the sales.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I'm just curious, in the last couple years, when you're starting to notice an explosion or a significant increase in membership due to a variety of factors, that there would be a analysis of an entire department-wide impact on the state budget. You just mentioned that you don't have the resources to do that. You don't have analysts. I would think as circumstances change, and they certainly have changed pretty significantly in the last 24 months, that you would reprioritize the need for, the next 3 years, as in we had better find some research analysts, or we are going to redeploy some of the existing resources that we have now towards analysis so we can predict what our cash flow needs are going to be and what the subsequent supplementals or just budgets in general for the next couple years. What is your plan to meet the state obligation cash flow for the next couple years? How are we going to get the new money? How are we going to get the additional money to pay for all the entire system's impact?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I apologize if I misdirected the response to Senator Bishop. The specific area of public assistance was what I was referring to as far as our ability to analyze the impacts of the backlog. And the costs associated to them. The department does employ analysts to analyze the budget and to analyze the effects of all the different programs that we administer and manage. And so that work is constantly underway, and we're constantly undergoing different analysis for how we can contain costs and where we can claim more federal funds in relationship to the programs that we administer as opposed to general funds. So that there's an extensive team of people that do that work on a pretty regular basis. I mean, it's not just during the budget preparation process, but it's throughout the year.
Senator Von Imhoff?
Okay, well, I was just curious, what's the plan to meet the increase?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, the increase to the department overwide, the plan really is that we, to the ability that we can, are containing the costs that we have control over. The cost drivers that we've spoken of in several hearings really are things that the department has not been able to control. The increase to Medicaid services is due to the number of people receiving benefits under that program, and the department is in discussions about what the eligibility criteria changes might be that would allow us to make some change to who's eligible. But those conversations are just in the beginning stages, and we're not to a place where we would even know what statutes would need to be revised and how those costs would impact other places in the state.
Senator Von Imhoff.
So your idea of obtaining new revenue to help support the expansion of Medicaid numbers is what I'm hearing just now is cost containment. So you really don't have an idea for new revenue at this point, other than maybe existing, looking to see other federal funds available and then changing Medicaid eligibility standards or eligibility standards. That's what I'm hearing?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, the Medicaid expansion revenues for the state are largely federal, so you're correct that if I understood you correctly there. As far as finding other new revenues for the department, many of our programs are already established nationwide. The funds that we have for those programs are, as Director Pitney said, for food stamps is 100% federally funded. Those aren't a part of the department's budget. To the extent that we can increase program receipt authority in areas where we can charge people for the work that we do, we're doing that. As far as other fund sources that the department has at its disposal, we're kind of already maxed to where we think we have the ability to expand on those, with the exception of federal claiming potential for any of the programs that we administer that we can increase our federal claiming.
And as part of the eligibility requirements that you are looking at, how much of a priority is that? Do you feel it is of the departments to try to address the eligibility requirements.
Chair, the conversation I think just came up in recent discussions. We were asked, the department was asked, whether or not eligibility criteria could be changed to help contain some of the growth in Medicaid. And so that's a very recent discussion. It's one that would be handled at the deputy commissioner and commissioner levels. So we're, I think, in the very beginning stages of discussing what those impacts would be and how we would go about making those changes.
And are you looking at trying to compare those and how Alaska stacks up with other states?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The state in itself is always looking at how services are being provided in other states and what those impacts to Alaskans are versus how the services are being offered in other communities or other states where maybe their challenges aren't the same as ours.
Senator Machicki, then Senator Bonham, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're kind of mixing a couple of categories here, but that's okay. I guess we're all asking some very good questions. But on the public assistance field services position, which is not related to Medicaid on eligibility, do they share any of those responsibilities? Because this is in the public assistance field services component.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, these positions in public assistance are the positions that determine eligibility for Medicaid services, food stamps, senior benefits, the heating assistance program, general relief, and adult public assistance.
Okay, Mr.
Senator Machicki.
I made the request about the 31 categories of eligibility. I think it's something we have to evaluate. The legislature determines eligibility. The department delivers the services, and it's just something. And I've talked about it with Senator Von Imhoff as well. You know, unemployment went up 0.1% in this recession. And those numbers don't collaborate in the increase in spending in both Medicaid and other services such as SNAP. We have a large population that we have to understand how we convert that number, which seemed to not be recorded in the Department of Revenue for being unemployed individuals. They're folks that are often dependent on these services and are really not a population that we consider as being employed or unemployed. If that were the case, there would be some correlation between those two numbers, and there doesn't seem to be. So my questions, not only on eligibility, is certainly helping to create some avenues for those individuals to succeed, to reduce the cost of the government at some point in the future. And it's a big project. It's a big question. We're not going to solve that for FY19, right? But it is what I'd like to do is understand where we compare, and we talked about that. Alaska is different, but I will be bringing those numbers back to finance for you to look at so that you understand those levels of eligibility and if we've gotten too generous or if they're set at the right place considering Alaska's differences.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sean, I just want to confirm that you said there's a huge vacancy factor.
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, so when I talk about the vacancy factor in regards to this conversation, it's not what we term as the budgeted vacancy factor, but the actual vacancies in the division, yes.
So is there a reason that you're not focusing then on hiring those positions versus asking for 41 new positions?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, we are in constant recruitment mode for these positions. The recruitment efforts are underway continually, and all of these positions have been, with the exception of a handful, have been filled at one point or another in the past 12 months. But keeping people in the positions is a challenge. The division is looking at ways to retain staff, but the positions themselves are very technical in nature, and so the natural progression is that folks promote or move to other positions. And so to the extent that we can retain staff internally to the department,
you know, those efforts to promote from within are underway as well. The infusion of 41 new positions would allow them to have more positions filled at a given period of time, rather than what we're experiencing right now is about a third of the eligibility technician positions are vacant. So infusing more positions into that base allows them to have more positions filled at any given period of time than they currently do now.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you. I'm not sure that that adds up. From a financial perspective, you need to hire the positions and get to full before you ask for more. But I want to make sure, because I pulled out my calculator to understand what you're asking. So we have about 260 positions that are managing about 11,000 new eligibility requests per month. And then you're giving us the increase in total caseload based on the 200,000 to 240,000, whatever that new number is, for FY19 to come up with somehow what each individual is managing. That looks like a huge number. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, yes, I believe, if I understand you correctly, the caseload in addition to the new applications is a different number, but yes, there.
So I divided 11,000 by 260 and got about 42 cases, so that would be a little bit over one per day that somebody would have to declare eligible.
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, for the new applications, that sounds about right. The ongoing casework, though, is the other body of work that's taking place on a regular basis as well, and those are recertifications, renewals, changes in situation. So if the case has any kind of a change, like the person moves or they have a change in household composition, their income levels change, all of those pieces of information go through the eligibility technician process as well. And so an eligibility technician has that casework as well.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that's above the 11,000 number or included in the 11,000 processing per?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, that is above the 11,000.
Thank you. And lastly, Mr. Chairman, as we have migrated through a waiver program through Commissioner Davidson of taking on IHS clients and processing them over into 100% state, they're being reimbursed 100% through the federal government. We had about 90, if I'm recalling correctly, we had about 90% of the population inside of the state Medicaid system now through the waiver program. We had those population numbers. Are they having to be recertified each time also?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, so just so I'm clear, you're talking about those recipients that are covered under IHS.
Correct. And we've migrated them into the state system, which has created available dollars to spend through the IH system, a single pot of money. But I'm wondering if that's creating our backlog and contributing to why we can't process.
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, I don't believe that the IHS recipients are any different than any of the other recipients in the aspect that if they apply for Medicaid services, they are included in our Medicaid application process. We aren't serving IHS recipients outside of the Medicaid process, and so I'm not sure if I'm understanding your question accurately or not, but I would say that we could get back to you on details as far as the breakout of applications received by category, if that helps.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that we've brought about 90,000, and I could have the number wrong, 90,000 enrollees over to the Medicaid system, and we have a backlog of 15,000, with 14,000 of them being Medicaid-specific. And I'm wondering if the eligibility, as we have transferred in trying to help IHS recipients in managing those, if that's what's causing the additional backlog of processing.
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, the majority of the application increase that we've seen in Medicaid services has been to the non-expansion regular Medicaid category in eligibility. And so the larger increases aren't attributable to the IHS recipients. But we, like I said, I think we could get you the information to support where we're seeing eligibility, the applications by eligibility group.
And if you are an IHS recipient, you still are considered an Alaskan citizen, and you are entitled to all the rights and benefits. So the way that I see it is that by them being classified under the IHS system, it is reducing the state's expenditure in that area. Because they're 100% eligible, and I think that the corporations are working to accomplish that through the MOAs. But what the health corporations are doing is something that they don't have to do, but they are assisting and getting the services and reducing the state's exposure on the general fund. Senator McKinnon.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with all of those comments. The issue for me on the 41 positions is it driving some of the need for processing? That is my only position, and not to be disparaging at all towards the use of the funds, but is it causing an increase in eligibility and those technicians that we're maintaining? It's a known expense, and you're absolutely right. There is some cost savings associated with that, going from a 50% recovery to 100% with the waiver program. But it may be related to why at least there's a request on the table for 41 new positions.
Further questions? Director Pitney?
Thank you. The next category of items are essentially fund cleanup, and I'll let Neil discuss those.
Neil.
So items 19 through 24 are cleanups of kind of dormant funds that haven't been used in some time. The total amount of authority being deposited back into the general fund is approximately $6.4 million across these funds. The first is the balance of the mining loan fund. No loans have been made out of this program since 1986, and no appropriations from this fund have been made since 2004. There's approximately $200,000 in the fund, which will be put back into the general fund. The Alternative Energy Conservation Revolving Loan Fund has about $2.8 million, and no activity has been on this fund since 2004 as well. The Investment Loss Trust Fund has approximately $2.3 million, and this is a fund that was created in response to the savings and loan crisis in the 1980s. And I believe it hasn't been used since 2012.
And this one actually isn't a fund cleanup. This is the amount of revenue available in that fund that isn't required in the fund for the purpose of the fund. There is more money in that fund that is essentially an insurance policy for retirement funds that existed in the 80s. But this is the amount over and above that. So this fund will remain. This is just the additional dollars in that fund that can be transferred to the general fund.
And similarly on line 22, this also is not a complete emptying of the fund. This is the proceeds on investment earnings in the Northern Tobacco Securitization Corporation, in the amount of $231,000. Line 23 and 24 are the Municipal Capital Project Matching Grant Fund and the Unincorporated Community Capital Project Matching Grant Fund. These two funds haven't been used since, I believe, 2004. The statute creating these funds say that after 5 years of inactivity, the balance of the fund goes back into the general fund. However, the statute didn't address investment earnings on principal in that fund. So these amounts are those investment earnings which sat in the fund after the rest of the balance was swept in, I believe, 2009.
When these balances are taken out, then those funds can be closed out and no longer show on the books as the program is sunset.
Beginning on the following page are amendments to the capital budget.
Mr. Senator Machicki.
So I'm just curious. I see at the bottom here, where does the $3.4 million go? I'm not sure I understand that. From line 21 through 24, I think line 19 and 20 are pretty clear. Where does those resulting funds end up when we're through with the process?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, this spreadsheet is representing the way that these transfers are recorded in our budgeting system. For technical reasons, loan funds, when the balance is pulled out of them, show up as a negative UGF amount. On the other items that are not loan funds, that value doesn't actually show up on this type of report. The money in those funds is going to be deposited into the general fund. So the full $6.4 million does get deposited into the general fund. However, just the way it reports in our budgeting system, those bottom four items don't show up.
So the first two lines, 19 and 20, show up as a negative expenditure. Lines 21 through 24 count as a positive revenue and no expenditure.
Senator Machicki?
Yeah, I'd like to see how that's accounted. I mean, I don't need to do it here, but I'd like to understand better how that's accounted in the revenue outlook.
They're just transferred from one account to another account.
All right. Understand.
Senator McKinnon?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at line 22 in the Northern Tobacco Securitization Corporation, and I'm wondering why we don't apply those towards the bond debt that we owe on those bonds instead of to the general fund.
Director.
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, we did apply a certain amount, and this was the amount in excess, and it could easily be applied. We were going through the process of addressing those funds that we could either get essentially zero out the available funds that were there. And so it was a choice. It can easily be put against the, if it's the will of this body, it could easily be put against the debt on those.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just suggest that we do that. I've actually looked at a long-term projection on that, and the money is going to run out before the debt that we owe is completed, and that money should be drilled into paying off that debt.
Thank you, Senator McKinnon. Director?
Beginning on line 28 on the following page are amendments to the capital budget. The first item is for the Department of Environmental Conservation. This is $4 million in federal receipts for the PM2.5 particulate matter non-attainment area in the Fairbanks North Star Borough. This is for voluntary heating device changeouts for residents. Line 29 is $10 million, 5.2 in general funds, 4.8 in ADA dividend. That's for the Department of Natural Resources for seismic data collection. Recently, federal action opened the 1002 area to oil and gas leasing, exploration, and development. Collecting seismic data will help to spur quicker development in that region, which is of benefit to the state.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Von Imhoff.
So what I understand is that by the state engaging initially seismic data, which we would then theoretically sell or share with potential investors, your very last statement was we hope to do this, get investment here quicker by starting off the bat and doing this seismic data. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, yes, that is correct.
Do you think that...
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. Do we know what the interest is for the 1002? Do we want to maybe wait and see if there are interested investors that are willing to take on the risk of doing the seismic data on their own and investing their own money rather than taking the state taking the lead right off the bat? Maybe we should, you know, wait a little bit and just see what interest is there already so we don't have to expend the dollars.
Right. Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, the that's a consideration. We believe, number one, $10 million doesn't go a long ways in a seismic shoot. So we would be a partner with other partners. 50% of the revenue from the leasing and royalty comes to the state. If there is additional interest, which we believe the seismic data information can provide, there will be more people interested in that lease sale, and they'll come on board. And this is our interest in expanding our return on investment. This is a very small amount to put us in a position to partner. This is in no way an amount of money that we could go it alone.
Senator Von Imhoff.
I tend to agree that putting money into an investment that would hopefully yield potential revenue in the future is a good place to put the money. However, we just have seen this supplemental and previous supplementals with significant amount of money for health and social services. So when you wear the hat that encompasses all 17 agencies, you know, you start to have to make some choices. Where's the priority? What's the priority? Because at this point it's a zero-sum game. So we give $10 million to seismic data, and then maybe we don't do the $2.5 million for 41 new positions. You know, I mean, it's those are the kind of choices, and I think it's like, what's the priority of the administration as a whole?
Director.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, there's priorities to meet current needs, and there's priority to position ourselves for a positive future, and this $10 million is positioning ourselves for a much more positive revenue future than we would have without it.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Pitney, so we would partner in shooting for data, or are we buying someone else's data under seismic?
Director.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, our interest here is twofold. One is to have there is a series of information that's currently available, and we want to bring experts on to analyze what is currently available. And this is also money to go into partnership with others. It could be private entities. It could be the federal government. It could be North Slope Borough, other entities. It could be some of the major oil companies or minor oil companies, but it's to do the shoot in combination with it. And then there would be a negotiation about the disposition of the data and who has it. And our interest is to have that data available to increase the interest in the lease sales.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I see that Andy Mack is online from the Department of Natural Resources. Might I ask him a question?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Mack, I'm looking at line 29 on the seismic data, and I'm recalling that we owe tax credits for seismic data. And I'm wondering if there's going to be crossover here because we've got a time lag on when we can pay for the tax credits in a proposal that we've talked about at this table before about that data becoming public information sooner if we allow some kind of transition with that seismic data. So are we paying for the data that we're giving tax credits on?
Commissioner?
Senator McKinnon, through the chair, the existing program where we paid tax credits for data would not be a part of what is being proposed here. So I think the committee's probably well aware there's a schedule, I guess, to pay back existing tax credits. And this would be, as Director Pitney said, a new proposal to go out and partner with companies or entities that are interested in shooting data. You know, one of the interesting facts that came out in the ANWR debate is that the CBO estimated that the initial two lease sales called for under the legislation, their estimate would be that it would generate $2.2 billion in bonus bids. We think that most of that money is going to come in the first of the two lease sales, and we are the recipients of half of the proceeds from that lease sale. So that's just an estimate. We want to make sure that that is the minimum, and we can build on that floor. And what's kind of interesting about this situation is that we've learned through the tax credit program how valuable and interesting this information is. We've had lots of people come to the Geological Material Center. The legislature, you know, many people in the legislature were involved in building that Geological Material Center. The existing tax credit data is now there, and we think this is another powerful tool, but it is separate from the existing program, but it would be a very powerful tool to generate interest and to make sure that we got the full value that is called for in this proposed lease sale.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Mack, then we can have confidence that we will not be paying for seismic data that we've offered tax credits on.
Commissioner?
Senator McKinnon, through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Von Imhoff.
So, Commissioner Mack, just to follow up with the statement you just said, that you think you're going to get $1 to $2 billion in lease revenue this first go-around. Is that what you just said?
Commissioner?
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, what the CBO said when they analyzed the proposed legislation is they thought that there are two lease sales proposed in the legislation. The first one within the next few years, they estimated between the two lease sales a total of $2.2 billion in bonus bids would be provided in that lease sale, and we are the recipient of 50%. So quick math, the CBO is saying we will receive $1.1 billion as a state in receipts as a result of the two lease sales. I believe, and I think the department believes, that most of that will come in the initial lease sale. So that's what we're looking at, and we're proposing this because, number one, that's a significant amount of revenue. We want to protect it. But also, too, we want to, if the opportunity exists, we want to make sure that we have as many bidders, qualified, responsible bidders in that lease sale as possible, and to increase the value of that lease sale.
Senator Von Imhoff.
So initially, initial estimates are about $1 to $2 billion, most of it coming in the first lease sale. And that may come with or without the $10 million investment in seismic data. Or is there, to what degree do you think would be the impact of this initial seismic data?
Commissioner?
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair. I think you're correct, Senator, in that it is hard to know with precision the level of interest that will exist in a particular lease sale. The truth is a lot of it is driven by opportunity. A lot of it is driven by price. Every company will come and look at the lease sale, look at the terms, look at the opportunity. But we do feel very strongly that, and what we've seen, and if you look at the tax credit program, which we have today, where companies can, you know, go out and shoot seismic, or they could go out and shoot seismic, and some of those costs would be, you know, reimbursable. What we've seen is a tremendous amount of activity in the seismic world in the Colville Delta. At the same time, we've seen tremendous prospects develop there, and there seems to be a very strong relationship. We think that seismic data will be very important and could be used, and we would use it in the sense that we would be able to talk about it as a state, and we would be able to promote the area because, you know, I mean, there's three big entities that are the recipients of the revenues from this area of the world. There's the federal government, there's the state government, and then there's some Alaska Native corporate land. And we're 50% on non-ASRC Cocktopic Inupiat land. We're 50% on recipients of bonus bids, rents, and royalties on the rest of the 1002. So even a small uptick in participation, we would recapture any of the costs that we might put in to in at this point.
Thank you, Commissioner Bishop.
Thank you. This is just more of an editorial comment, Commissioner, you can listen if you want to comment. That's fine, but I just like to take a step back. So it's $10 million. We've been over 40 years trying to get in 1002. 40 years. I believe, if I'm not speaking out of turn, and if I am, somebody can correct me either on the record or after, that I think maybe this legislature, this past legislatures has approved monies to stand up groups over the years to try to lobby our members of Congress to get into 1002. So now here we are after 40 some years, and I'm looking at $10 million and I'm wondering if that's enough, because I don't know if we're ever going to get back in there again. And I would, common sense would prevail if you had good data and you had access to that data, that you could drive those numbers that the Congressional Budget Office is anticipating going forward. So with that, I will yield. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Do you have comments upon Senator Bishop's remarks, Commissioner?
I agree. It's a one-shot deal here. To the extent that we believe that a vast majority of the area will be leased in that first lease sale, which we anticipate soon over the next few years.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is a risk, of course. It can go both ways, right? So you have a lot of seismic work that's been done in the 1002 area, not a lot, if any, 3D. Just keep in mind that investing in an analysis that may show some areas more favorable than others in advance could result in discounting or very little interest in some of the acreage. So that's something worth considering there, Commissioner. If you were to lease without that knowledge, sometimes folks will take a risk believing that the entire area has some potential. We're gonna sort of pinpoint interest in fewer lease areas, I believe. I'd love to hear your comments on that. But I just two other things. We have the state owns a substantial amount of current data in other areas that we've not had time to analyze. And I don't know that there's an effort to analyze that data. And reputable companies have been marching forward, particularly in the NPRA, mostly because of a stable tax environment, or what seems like maybe a stable tax environment going forward. So I Just to remember, in my opinion, advanced seismic data can support our efforts in the 1002 area, and in some ways could narrow the scope of leases that folks remain highly interested in.
Thank you for those comments. Director?
I think we are on really our last substantive item, and it's the NPRA impact grants. The total for the impact grants is $11.6 million. The process that's been used is we forward the prior year's impact grant numbers, and then after the December 15 data, but before this date, the communities put in their requests through the Department of Commerce. There are several requests from the communities that receive the NPRA Alaska Impact Grants. We can go through those line by line, but it's really just adjusting for the amount of revenue anticipated, and that revenue came from the recent lease sale in NPRA last December.
Maybe you could just provide the list to the community, to the committee. Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I noticed that on 38 and 42, we're seeing a 25% administrative cost, and I'm wondering if that same cost is on all of the grants that are being provided, or just the two, and if so, why?
Okay. Director?
Through the Chair, Senator McKinnon, we can get with Department of Commerce and Economic Development and see if there are specific rules on these grants that provide for that. The Commerce has a set of rules that is followed, and they prioritize the grants that are sent in and the
Senator
eligible
McKinnon.
Costs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Have these grants ever been audited?
Director.
Spending stream.
Through the Chair, Senator McKinnon, I can find that out as well with Department of Commerce and Economic Development.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator McKinnon. Director.
That closes our presentation. All of the rest of the items were NPRA grants, the distribution.
That concludes your presentation?
That concludes our presentation.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I realize that item 5 may have been discussed at length at this table, but I've not had a chance to hear that. So I'd appreciate, if not here in private, in my office, to hear some details. My questions are, what is the population of Newtok? How much housing is needed? Are people actually willing to move to the new community? What's the comparison between building new versus refurbishing these old barracks? How old are those barracks? And does it really make sense to refurbish, install, ship and install versus building new? We're talking about $5 million. I don't know if that would build new or not, but I'd appreciate more information on it.
Director.
Through the Chair, Senator Stevens, we will get with you in the next day or two.
Any additional questions by members of the Finance Committee? Any closing comments, Director? If not, tomorrow, Tuesday, February the 20th, we will be meeting here at 9 a.m. to discuss two bills, Senate Bill 8, which is the PFD contribution to tribal governments, and Senate Bill 154, PFD contributions to the general fund. Is there anything else to come before the committee at this time? Seeing none, we will stand adjourned.